Thank you for coming. Welcome. Welcome to the spring. I know. The spring 2014 BIND4 lecture. My name is Carl Johnson. I'm the executive director of Chesterton House, which is a center for Christian studies here at Cornell and the sponsor of the Alan T. and Linda M. BIND4 lecture. The BIND4 lecture is made possible by a gift from Carl and Elaine Noyce. Carl was a Cornell student in the class of 1976, and he names this lecture after his late friend Al BIND4, who was class of 1966, and his wife Linda. We extend our greeting to them as they watch from sunny Southern California, along with many others who are joining us on the live stream around the country and around the world. And if I may just address you for a moment, those of you tuning in from warmer climates, before you get nostalgic for your time back on East Hill, I will mention that the wind chill this evening is supposed to be as low as negative 19 degrees, which is balmy compared to a couple of weeks ago. I heard a student who was walking up here mentioned that the polar vortex had stalled over Ithaca. I would also like to thank and acknowledge the Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management for their co-sponsorship of this evening's lecture. The BIND4 lectureship is designed to address questions related to faith and public life. And that is a good reminder to please turn electronics off. Today's lecture is entitled Worldview, the Meaning of Life and the End of Poverty. And as the title suggests, the lectureship is designed to take on big questions, like the end of poverty, like worldview. And as if that were not enough for one lecture, we decided to throw in the meaning of life as well. Building a better world for children. That is the motto of World Vision. World Vision is a Christian relief and development organization internationally with 45,000 staff in almost 100 countries, making it one of the largest humanitarian organizations in the world. And our distinguished guest, Mr. Richard Stearns, is the president of World Vision U.S. Mr. Stearns is a native of Syracuse, New York. He majored in neurobiology here at Cornell. He took an MBA from the Wharton School and then began his career in marketing at the Gillette Company. In the 1980s and 1990s, he worked his way up to the role of president at Parker Brothers Games, later served as vice president at the Franklin Mint, and also as president of Lennox, manufacturer of fine china. Incidentally, my son, who is here this evening, would like to know why you would ever want to do anything other than Monopoly. You can speak to him about that later on. In January 1998, a headhunter phoned Mr. Stearns to speak with him about the presidency of World Vision, to which our guest responded, "I'm not qualified, I'm not interested, and I'm not available." But fortunately, for people all over the world, this headhunter had a stubborn streak. And later that year, Mr. Stearns left Lennox to begin serving as president of World Vision. Under his leadership, the organization has grown and flourished, and it is now more than a $1 billion a year organization. Which, as he pointed out over dinner, means he has to raise $3 million a day, and he's not done yet today. Mr. Stearns is the author of four books, most notably The Hole in Our Gospel, which was named the 2010 Christian Book of the Year, and Unfinished, a sequel of sorts published last year. His books have received many rave reviews, but none more pithy than the Amazon reviewer who describes The Hole in the Gospel as simply the best book ever. Both books are available for purchase after the lecture at a very subsidized rate, so we hope you will avail yourselves of that opportunity. Mr. Stearns has appeared on CNN, Fox, ABC, NBC, and PBS, has written pieces for the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Huffington Post, and other media outlets. He travels tirelessly around the world to speak and to advocate for the poor. Following his lecture and before the question and answer session, we'll have the opportunity to listen in as our guest is interviewed by Dr. Chris Barrett, who I would also like to introduce at this time. Dr. Barrett is the Stephen B. and Janice G. Ashley Professor of Applied Economics and Management at Cornell. He also currently serves as the David J. Nolan Director of the Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. He has published 14 books and more than 260 journal articles or book chapters, which have attracted over 13,000 citations. His research focuses on poverty, hunger, food security, economic policy, and environmental stress, and so for obvious reasons, he is the perfect person to serve as our interlocutor with our guest. With no further ado, please join me in welcoming Mr. Richard Stearns.
Well, good evening, and thank you, Carl, for that introduction. It's always disappointing with an introduction like that. The speaker is always bound to be disappointing after that build-up. So about half of what he said is true, but I am really delighted to be back here. It's been a long time since I trudged up Live Slope and went to school at Cornell. I trudged up this morning at 7:15, and I about died by the time I got to the Strait. And I was so much younger then. But I love coming back to Cornell, even though I don't get back here very often. I live in Seattle, Washington now, and Ithaca is simply not on the way to anywhere. And it's very remote, and it's difficult to get to. But, you know, it's kind of a magical place for me. And if you're an undergraduate here, you really want to enjoy your time here because you'll look back fondly and realize there's very few times in your life that were so magical and special as being in this community, scholars and incredibly interesting people, and you'll take these memories with you the rest of your life. I'm especially nostalgic here because I feel like I came of age here, that Cornell University opened up the world to me. I'll talk a little bit about my background, but I did not come from a background that would have predicted me to go to Cornell, and it's also where I met the love of my life, my wife of now almost 39 years. We were married in Ithaca, and we had our reception at the Andrew Dixon White House. We had our first date here. It was a blind date. I'll tell you a little bit about that later. And so I love to come back, especially because of the weather. I mean, this is, and I really wanted to come in February so that the nostalgia would be even deeper, you know, than it has been. You know, before I begin tonight, I just want to recognize a couple of people. My sister Karen is here, and get a little emotional. Give me a minute. My sister and I grew up in kind of a difficult home, and probably without her, I would not have made it to Cornell. She was my older sister. I know you wouldn't know it to look at her. But she just kept emphasizing that education, education, education. You can be somebody. You don't have to be like your mother and father. And my sister was a little slow getting her PhD. I think she was 61 when she got her PhD, so the longest student maybe record in history. But she's now a professor at SUNY Cortland and teaches young teachers who are looking to teach at the high school or elementary level or some of the college level. So I wanted to just recognize her as kind of my first teacher. I paid her to say that. I also want to recognize Merrill and Margaret Stern, who are here in the audience. And Merrill, when I was a young agnostic and atheist and just on the verge of belief and struggling with the Christian faith, he would sit patiently with me. Margaret and Merrill would invite me and Renee over to dinner. and he would talk to me about the deep things of faith and theology. He not only baptized me, he married me. So I owe a lot to Merrill and Margaret, who have been great spiritual mentors in my life as well. So thank you to them. For those of you who don't know, Merrill was a longtime pastor at Bethel Grove Bible Church here, where I was married. He was the chaplain to Cornell University in the late 60s with Father Daniel Berrigan, the radical priest. He founded Christ Chapel, I think, in the 1980s, and Christ Chapel is still, he's retired, but still attends Christ Chapel over here on the other side of Tripphammer. So, great church community if you want to check it out. Well, I'm not sure why you came tonight. I'm not sure I would have come to listen to me many years ago when I was a student at Cornell. Maybe it was the title of the lecture that attracted you, Worldview, the Meaning of Life, and the End of Poverty. And discovering the meaning of life in a 40-minute lecture sounds like a pretty good deal. If you haven't figured it out yet, I'm going to give you the answer tonight. Maybe some of you came because you're interested in global poverty and justice issues and their solutions. But either way, thank you for coming tonight. My hope is that some of the ideas I present will provoke and motivate some of you, especially you younger folks, to invest your lives in one of the great endeavors of our time, ending extreme poverty in our world, which I believe is possible in our lifetime. My thesis tonight is that the kind of world we live in is shaped by people. Obviously, it seems obvious, but the world we live in is shaped by people, and people are shaped by value systems. The value systems kind of become like our operating system, and they inform all of the decisions that we make. And values shape worldview and the way we look at the world and often how we behave in the world. And, of course, all of these things are based on the foundation of what is truth, and what is true and good and what is right and what is wrong in our world. So the lecture tonight is going to be a little less about global poverty and all of the academic ideas and solutions about it, although in the Q&A I think we'll get into some of that. It's going to be a little bit more philosophical. So who better to start with if you're talking philosophy than Stephen Colbert from his late-night political satire show? But in 2006, Colbert coined a brand new word on his show, and the word was truthiness. And he invented this word in order to describe how politicians could bend the truth to support their actions. And the word caught on. It's kind of a viral thing. And that year, Merriam-Webster actually named it the word of the year for 2006. And here is the Webster definition of truthiness. Truthiness, noun, the quality of preferring concepts or facts one wishes to be true, rather than concepts or facts known to be true. So you can see where politicians would come in. They kind of make up their own truth. And when announcing that truthiness had been selected as its word of the year, by the way, it beat out Google and terrorism as the word of the year in 2006, Merriam-Webster President John Moore said this. He said, "We're at a point where what constitutes truth is a question on a lot of people's minds. And truth has become up for grabs." And then he said, truthiness is a playful way for us to think about a very important issue, the issue of truth. So the idea of truthiness is quite attractive because it lets each one of us choose what we prefer to be true rather than have to accommodate our behavior to what is actually true. But of course, all of this begs the question, just what is truth, which is the question that Pontius Pilate asked Jesus as he came before him for trial. So this is a pretty foundational question, what is truth, and it's worth the price of the lecture tonight. So this question of what is truth, there's even a question that precedes that that I think is asked a lot today, and especially on university campuses. Is there any such thing as truth? Or is this an elusive concept that there really is no such thing as truth? Now, I'm only an amateur philosopher, so I won't try to make this argument from philosophy. But I will appeal to your common sense. If you assert that there is no truth, how can your statement be true? You know, so there's a little bit of a contradiction for philosophers there. If there's no such thing as truth, then your statement is not true either. So the reality, you know, that'll spin you for a while thinking about that. The reality is it's virtually impossible to live our lives at all unless we make some assumptions about what is true, what is false, what is right, and what is wrong. And those choices and assumptions shape our world in very profound ways. So why is this matter of foundational truth so important? Because truth, I think we understand, has implications. If you believe that human life has little value, you might become a murderer, a serial killer. Why not? Joseph Stalin once famously said, "One death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a statistic." And he proceeded to kill 40 million people in the 20th century. So truth is pretty important. But on the other hand, if you believe that human life is precious, if that is your truth, you might choose to become a doctor instead of a Joseph Stalin. Or you might even send your resume to World Vision at the end of the semester this year when you graduate. So another example, if you believe the poor are poor because they're just losers in the Darwinian lottery, then why would you bother to help them at all? It's just natural selection playing itself out in our world. Truth has implications. Now, every choice we make is based on the foundational truths that you and I have embraced personally in our lives. So for a minute, I want to combine science fiction with theology to illustrate a point. Now, when I was a kid, I read a lot of sci-fi and superhero comic books growing up. My sister can attest to this. They were all over the house. And I will tell you that I did not list this activity on my Cornell application when I applied. But I read a lot of sci-fi comic books. So I want to invite you to take a little sci-fi journey of the imagination with me for a few minutes that I hope will cause you to see some of the fundamental questions in life from a little different perspective. I want you to imagine now for a moment how strange it would be if you went to sleep tonight, wherever you go, West Campus, go to your home or your apartment, but tomorrow morning when you woke up, you were not in Ithaca, New York anymore. You were actually in another planet, in a galaxy far, far away, on the other side of the universe, without any idea how you got there. You went to bed in Ithaca, you woke up on another part of the universe. Now, bear with me, this seems a little silly, but I really want you to mentally put yourself in that place and begin to feel what might be racing through your mind when you wake up in this strange place. You look out the window and you see a race of alien beings. They're going to and fro. They're in a setting with bizarre buildings and architecture. There's a little of that on the Cornell campus these days. But you have no idea where you are or how you got there or who all of these other beings that were obviously there before you, who they are. You find yourself absolutely bewildered. Your pulse would quicken. Panic would set in. Your mind would race desperately to make sense out of this astonishing mystery. Where am I? How did I get here? And what's going to happen to me now? Now, just imagine how totally freaked out, we said that in the 70s, how freaked out you would feel if that happens. And 1,000 questions would be rushing through your mind at that moment as you tried to figure out this great puzzle, this great mystery. In fact, I don't think it would be an exaggeration to say that at that moment, figuring out the mystery that had just happened to you would be the most all-consuming priority of your life at that moment. Now, are you finding this a little bit preposterous, this idea, this journey of the imagination? Well, here's the news I have for you tonight. That exact thing did happen to you, everyone in this room, and every person who has ever lived. Sometime in the past 100 years, every one of us, we're born on the third planet from the sun, from a smallish star in a solar system in the Milky Way galaxy, in the middle of an incomprehensibly vast universe. I want you to think about it. We all woke up one day on planet Earth with absolutely no idea how we got here. We woke up in a particular culture, at a particular time, in a particular place, among a particular group of people who had been there before we arrived. We kind of woke up in the middle of an unfolding story on planet Earth, and a story that began before we were born and will continue after we die. Now, the only difference between my little sci-fi story and the reality that every one of us woke up on this planet in the middle of the solar system with no idea how we got here is that we did not arrive here as adults. We arrived here as infants. And so we came to age in a very gradual way. And so we didn't feel the shock of arrival and the shock of existence in the same way you would if you woke up on another planet tomorrow morning. But nevertheless, I want to argue that the mystery is just as profound as it would be in my little science fiction adventure. And every person in this room and on the planet and in all history had to come to terms with that mystery and try to answer some of the fundamental questions that were raised. Questions like, where did we come from? How did we get here? Why are we here? Who created everything we see, the universe, the earth, the beauty that we see, the complexity of the world around us? How did all of this come into being? And who gave us the ability to think and to reason? And how is it that we have the ability to produce art and music and laughter and love, skyscrapers and iPads? What does it all mean? What does it all mean, anyways? What is truth? You see, these are the deep questions of our very existence on planet Earth. These foundational questions of why and how and who are pretty well common to all people of all ages. Every human being ever born woke up into this same mystery. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about Nelson Mandela or Albert Einstein, Martin Luther King Jr., or Kim Kardashian. They all woke up into this existence. They came of age, and they had to struggle to make sense of the life they found themselves in. I would argue that the first three on my list did a better job of figuring it out than Miss Kardashian. That's a personal opinion. So then, how do we make sense out of this great mystery story? And I want to argue now that there are really only three choices that people can make to explain the story that we woke up in the middle of. The first one is to believe there is no story. There is no story. We can choose to believe that everything we see and experience in the world is totally random and without meaning. There is no truth. We are just a meaningless species on a meaningless planet in a meaningless universe. There is therefore no God, no truth, and no real defining purpose to life at all. When I was in college here at Cornell, there was a popular bumper sticker that said, vote for Lincoln. No, it was a popular bumper sticker that said, it summed up life like this. It said, life sucks and then you die. Life sucks and then you die. It's kind of the epithet of the true atheist. You know, there is no meaning. There is no purpose. You are just alive. It sucks and then you're dead and it's over. Not exactly a motto that makes you want to jump out of bed in the morning and get to your 8 o'clock class. But I think the best summary of this worldview, there is no story, there is no meaning, that I've ever read came from an advice columnist named Coquette. And Coquette wrote for the ill-fated internet newspaper, online newspaper called The Daily, which I used to subscribe to. And a reader wrote to ask Coquette's advice. She asked a question about the significance of her life. How do I find significance in my life? And you've got to love this response. Coquette says this, kill your ego because nothing you do will ever matter. That's okay, though. It's not just you. It's all of us. It's taken 100,000 years for our species to hump and grunt its way into momentary dominance on this pale blue dot. But nothing we've accomplished is all that outstanding when you consider that a Mall of America-sized asteroid is all it would take to turn humanity into the next thin layer of fossil fuels. Greatness is nothing but the surface tension on the spit bubble of human endeavor. On a geological time scale, our measurable effect on the planet is a greasy burp. We are 7 billion tiny flecks of talking meat stuck to an unremarkable mud ball hurtling through space in an unimaginably vast universe for no particular reason. There is no difference between kings and cripples, my friend. We're all the same hodgepodge of primordial goo, and the pursuit of greatness is a fool's errand. What an inspiring worldview to live by, Coquette. You go, girl. We are just 7 billion tiny flecks of talking meat stuck to an unremarkable mud ball hurtling through space in an unimaginably vast universe for no particular reason. Well, people who believe choice number one, there is no story, Coquette is my primary example, often just rumble through life, doing whatever feels good until the clock runs out. They have the mentality of eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. But you see, because we don't live in isolation, there are implications to making choice one. A person's view of truth always has consequences. So what happens when your actions and decisions come into conflict with my actions and decisions? Since we are both just tiny flecks of talking meat, spinning in the same hodgepodge of primordial goo, there's really no such thing as right or wrong. So the only mechanism to resolve our dispute is force or power, survival of the fittest. And if you really believe that human beings are no more than flecks of meat, then taking a human life really has no more significance than squashing an ant or plucking a mushroom. I want you to think again about Joseph Stalin. This was his view of the world. You see, Kopets' worldview is essentially the worldview of someone who is a pure atheist. Life is pretty much meaningless. There is no higher purpose to our lives. Now, most atheists, and if some of you are here tonight, I hope you are, actually, most atheists would not confess this philosophy as bluntly as Kopet does, because most people, it's too shocking. Most people would think you mad if you walked around espousing the philosophy that Kopet, espoused. And I actually think that very few atheists actually live out their lives and make their life choices consistent with their worldview that there is no such thing as meaning and truth. But they don't actually live logically according to their own belief system. Well, that gets me to choice number two you can make. So there is no story, choice number one. Number two is a very popular one. Make up your own story. Make up your own story. This is kind of where truthiness comes in. You see, true atheists who believe there are no story at all, they're actually quite rare in the world. Far more common are the people who make up their own stories and live according to their own ideas. And these people create views of reality that make sense to them. They develop value systems consistent with their views, and then they live out their own homemade realities. They decide not to think about the bigger questions of life, the bigger mystery, much at all, and they don't often really care why they got there or how they got here. They're not necessarily selfish or egotistical people. They can be quite pleasant and admirable and inspiring. And at their core, they're quite practical, and their philosophy kind of goes like this. I'm here. I have a life to live. So I'm going to make some basic decisions about what I believe, how I will live, and what values will guide me as I walk through life. It's a very reasonable proposition. These are what I call the what's right for you may not be right for me people. Because truth is relative, and you make up your own truth, and we all make up our own truth. And they don't really require that everybody agree with them. They often begin sentences with, I think that, or I believe that, and then they fill in the blanks with their own homebrew. Things like God helps those who help themselves. I believe that. Somebody might say that. Or I believe that the one who dies with the most toys wins. You know, that might be a homebrew that you could live by. Well, here's where our 2006 word of the year, truthiness, comes in handy. The quality of preferring concepts or facts one wishes to be true rather than concepts or facts known to be true. So who are these people who've chosen to make up their own stories about truth? Actually, this make-up-your-own-story approach to life's mystery can produce both monsters and saints. They could be drug dealers or human traffickers making up their own rules and their own right and wrong, just as easily as they could be school teachers and homemakers. They might be NBA all-stars or Fortune 500 CEOs, and usually they share a fairly universal human goal of happiness, the pursuit of happiness. It's just that some pursue their happiness through violence and crime, and others through hard work and education. Some even find it in helping their fellow man and being generous. I know a lot of people in the humanitarian space who would fit into this category. They just, the worldview they've made for themselves basically is a worldview that says, I want to invest my life in making the world a better place. And they live according to that worldview, and some of them are incredibly wonderful people. The only thing all of these people have in common is they invented their own truth. They made it up. You see, people in category two can live an entire lifetime pursuing happiness and fulfillment without really worrying whether there is some deeper truth or deeper meaning or maybe a bigger story that they are a part of. So choices one and two, there is no story, or I make up my own story. And there's a third option. The story has an author. The story that we woke up in, the meaning of the universe, the meaning of life, there's an author who's writing this epic story. Now, if you read a mystery novel, there's one thing you know for sure. Somebody wrote it. There was an author. The author creates the setting, the place where the story happens. the author creates the plot, and every character in the story is created by the author. And here's the thing about authors creating characters. Every character in the story of every author was written into that story to play a role, a very specific intentional purpose. And that has really great significance for our life, because if there is an author who's written this story, and he's created you and written you into the story, the fact that you're here says you've been written into the story, then that creator, that author, actually has a purpose for writing you into the story, and your life matters. No matter who you are, you can be a cripple, you can be a homeless person, but the author has written you into the story to play a role. Now, I have to be frank in stating that all of this requires a very significant leap of faith, and philosophers have been debating the existence of God for millennia. I will not bring an end to the debate tonight, but again, I would appeal to your common sense, something philosophers don't always have in abundance. Doesn't it make more sense to believe that this story has an author than to believe that everything we see and everything experience is without meaning and purpose? You know, I'm going to do a little personal biographical stuff here now, but you know, in my time at Cornell, I majored in neurobiology and animal behavior. I had the thrill of studying the intricacies of the human brain, the amazing variety and diversity of plant and animal life. And at that time, I was maybe an agnostic leaning toward atheism. I was in category two, making up my own story and having a good time doing it and living according to my own rules. But what kept nagging at me during my studies at Cornell was that the natural world that I was studying was so filled with beauty and complexity and wonder that I could not help but speculate how something so marvelous could really come into being. Did it really make any sense to think it had all showed up just by accident? Did it really make sense that the most beautiful painting I had ever seen did not have a painter? There was no painter. I could have described to you the detailed steps in the life cycle of the monarch butterfly. I remember that, of course. The amazing fact that 100 million monarch butterflies mysteriously every year migrate thousands of miles to the same hillside in the same pine forest in Mexico. They weigh a fraction of an ounce, but they can navigate and fly several thousand miles to an exact destination to the same small patch of land every year and in every generation. You see, I could describe all of this to you and I could get an A on the exam, but I was at a loss to explain why there even was such a thing as a butterfly. Does it make sense to you that the diversity of the natural world, the vastness of the universe, the remarkable ability of human beings to love and reason and create music and art, technology, to build civilizations, that all of this just happened randomly? And even if it did, the universe had to come from somewhere. Now, I know that my little is naive, and it will not persuade academics who are battling this out in universities, but it does make sense to most people I talk to. If you look at our amazing universe, you reach the similar conclusion that there had to be a painter, there had to be an author. And I actually believe it takes a lot more faith to believe what Coquette believes, that there was no creator and that we are just talking flecks of meat with no purpose in our lives, than it takes to believe these words: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So the point of all of this philosophy, remember, is to make the argument that our understanding of truth affects our worldview and that our worldview affects the world. But let me get a little bit more personal. So my own life at Cornell went through a seismic change. My life and worldview went through a seismic change. In my senior year, I got fixed up on a blind date with a freshman. And, you know, it's funny how God changes your life. And she was a Christian and I was not. And despite our differences, we kind of fell in love. It was spring in Ithaca, and love breaks out when the snow melts, right? But every time we talked about faith and God, we would get angry. I would say, I don't believe in it. I think it's the Easter Bunny. I respect you. You know, what's true for you may not be true for me. I was that guy. And why can't we just be happy together, respecting one another's beliefs? But you see, for her, truth had implications. And she knew that she could never marry a man that didn't share her deepest views about reality and God and love and truth. And so she about 9 months into the relationship, I was now in graduate school at Penn, she broke up with me. And because I issued her an ultimatum, I said, I will never become a Christian. So you have a choice to make. And we were angry, and I said, you have a choice to make, me or God. Number one, do you detect the arrogance in that statement? And number two, do you see any wisdom in that statement when you're giving an ultimatum to the woman you love? And, of course, she made the right choice, right? She chose God, and so she broke up with me. And it was actually quite devastating because we really did love one another. And it was terrible for both of us because it was just a terrible moment. And I slunk away and went back to my studies and just had a heavy heart for weeks. And then I said, you know, I've got to find out more about this Jesus that caused me to lose the woman I love. You know, why? You know, who is this Jesus? He must be a stud. And so I started to read. And I read, and I read, and I read, and I read books on comparative religion. I read books on archaeology and biblical documents. Are they reliable? I read books on science and scripture. I read C.S. Lewis. I read John Stott. I read comparative religion and philosophy, just about everything I could get my hands on, all the while I'm trying to get my graduate degree at Wharton. So I would read till like 2 in the morning, you know, finish my studies at 11 and read till 2. And over that period, I read 50 or 60 books. You know, some of them were brilliant and some of them were awkward and some of them were poorly written. But at the end of that time, I closed a book. I think it was C.S. Lewis' Miracles, which for me was a very profound book. And I asked myself a question. If I had to bet my life on whether Jesus was who he said he was, what would I bet? Because he said he was the Son of God who had come to reconcile the human race back to God through his death on the cross. And I said, if he is the person he said he was, do I believe that? And would I be willing to bet my life on it? And I realized at that moment that we all bet our lives on something. And I had been betting my lives on my own homebrew of philosophy and truth as I wanted to know it. And I bet my life on that. And Jesus was saying, bet your life on me, and I'll never let you down. And so in that moment, I realized that I had crossed over from unbelief into belief. And I kind of fell to my knees in my dormitory at the Wharton School of Business. I don't think anybody has ever become a Christian in that place. They worship another god there called Mammon. Some of you are going there probably in a year or two. But and I just mumbled an awkward prayer. I said, God of the universe, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to do it, but I know I want to live my life for you. And I don't even know what that means, God, so help me. In Jesus' name, amen. Or I might have said in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen, because I've been kind of a nominal Catholic growing up. And well, I felt no lightning bolt at that moment. I didn't see birds didn't start to sing in my dorm. And but after that day, my life was never the same. And I can honestly say it's been over 40 years, and I have never looked back, and I've never had a doubt, and I've never regretted that choice that I made, because I kind of leapt into the light, not into the darkness. I leapt into the arms of a God who was ready to greet me and catch me and hold me and lead me and guide my life. And my life was not the same after that. I had a new purpose. I had a new understanding of truth. I had a new worldview that all came out of Scripture. And those of you that are Christians know what that is all about. And I had a new sense of wonder when I looked around the world, because now it all made sense. I knew where butterflies came from. I knew, you know, why human beings have the ability to reason and love and create art and music and beauty, because we were made in the image of God, the Creator. And he endowed us with all of these abilities. And yes, a few months later, I was back with this woman I loved. And we were married 18 months later. And she regrets that she couldn't come this week, but she's back in Seattle. We've been married 39 years, so, and 5 children, but I'll get to that. So how does all this worldview stuff influence our choices? And how do these choices influence the world? Well, let me continue. I want you to fast forward 24 years in my life. Carl alluded to this a few minutes ago. over those 24 years, Renee and I had five children. She went to law school. My career took off. I became a CEO at age 33, Monopoly, Clusari, and Nerf Balls. I became the CEO of a second company, you know, Lennox China, the company that makes china for the White House. And with all of the success, Renee and I had bought our dream house in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We had a 10-bedroom antique fieldstone farmhouse on 5 acres, a beautiful house built in 1803. And we were living the American dream. Now, here's where I get to a little bit of my early life. Important for you to understand the story that my sister and I came from a broken home, alcoholic father. In fact, neither of our parents finished high school. There were never any books in our house unless we brought them home from school. And when I was about 10 years old, our parents separated. There was a bankruptcy. The bank foreclosed on our house. We were literally evicted from the little house that we lived in. My father moved to an apartment, and we moved to a rental. And for the next number of years, you know, I was raised by my mother. My sister was 6 years older than me. So you have to understand that for me to go from that background to two Ivy League schools and then to the top of the corporate world was nothing short of a miracle. It was the American dream that you hear about, that you read about. And in 1998, I was enjoying every bit of that American dream and that success story. I was driving a Jaguar XK8, which is my company car. I was traveling to Paris, Tokyo, London, Milan for sourcing trips and, you know, negotiating partnerships with other tableware companies around the world. And then, as Carl indicated, one day my phone rang in the office, and it was that executive recruiter looking for a CEO for a Christian charity called World Vision. And I was pretty sure there was no money in that for me. So I was trying to get off the phone fairly quickly. And for those of you that don't know, I guess Carl said this, it's one of the, World Vision is one of the largest NGOs on the planet. We've got about 45,000 staff working in 100 countries. We estimate that we help in one way or another about 100 million people every single year. Annual budget of $2.7 billion globally. And our mission is to help people with water, health, food, nutrition, education, economic development, just to name a few of the things that World Vision does. And maybe in the Q&A session, I'd be happy to take questions about that. But anyways, this headhunter was convinced I would make a great candidate for the job. And I said to him, you're not looking for somebody like me. You're looking for someone that's part CEO, part Mother Teresa, and part Indiana Jones. And I don't know many people that have those three attributes, but I'll try to think. And if I think of a name, I've got your phone number, I'll call you. And then he said, what about you? And I laughed kind of nervously, and I said, you do know I'm running a luxury goods company. I've never been to Africa. I've never done fundraising. I know nothing about global poverty. I have no theological background. It's a Christian organization. Other than that, I'm a perfect candidate. And so he said, I want to have dinner with you because I think you're a great candidate. I said, No, I won't have dinner with you. I said, this is not going to happen. I don't want to waste your time. I'm busy. You're busy. And then the question that stopped me in my tracks was when he said, Rich, are you willing to be open to God's will for your life? Well, what a terrible question to ask somebody. That's a little personal. None of your business. And how about you? Are you willing to open, you know, you go first. Now, for a Christian, you know, the answer, the automatic answer, of course I do. I'm a Christian. That's what we do. Bring it. You know, God's will for my life, I'm all about that. I'm pretty sure it's to make a lot of money in the corporate world and live in this mansion. I'm pretty sure that's God's will for my life. How else did I get here? I give thanks to God. And but, you know, as I really actually wrestled with that question, these were the questions underneath the question. Rich, are you willing to quit that corporate CEO job it took you 25 years to get? Coming from where you came from, you have climbed to the top of the mountain. Are you willing to walk away from your career, maybe commit career suicide, take a 75% pay cut when you've got five kids under the age of 19 that all have to go through college, and two of them through Cornell, which is egregious in its tuition? And Rich, then there's the matter of that 10-bedroom fieldstone farmhouse on 5 acres. Are you and Renee willing to sell the house of your dreams and put it on the market? Are you willing to be open to God's will for your life? What a terrible question to have to wrestle with. But, you know, those are superficial things, cars and houses and money. There were questions like these. Are you willing to enter the pain and the suffering of the poorest of the poor, Rich? Are you willing to travel to garbage dumps and where children scavenge for food and enter the stench of refugee camps? Are you willing to hold dying babies in your arms and see the eyes of famine staring back at you from the faces of children? Are you open to God's will for your life, Rich? Are you willing to follow me there? I don't know about you, but those were kind of uncomfortable questions for me. So how does a person make a big decision like that? You see, it gets back to the foundational issues. What is true? What is right? Who is God? What is his character? You see, if life is about the pursuit of personal happiness, one simply chooses the thing that will make them happy. I remember telling my mother, our mother, about my decision. She was living in an assisted living facility in Florida at that point and was getting some financial support from her son. And she said, "What? You've got it made. Why would you do this? You know, you've got it made." And, you know, in her lens, her baby boy had become CEO of the great American companies and was making big money, living in a mansion. I mean, this was like, my son made it. You did it. You know, she was proud. But I had to tell her, I said, "Mom, it isn't about me and my happiness. It's about truth. It's about my relationship with God, who cares deeply about the poor. This God cares deeply about the poor. It's about doing more than talking the talk about my faith, but it's about walking the walk." You see, as a follower of Christ, I was driven by an objective truth that was bigger than me. And I was motivated by a set of values that Jesus not only taught, but he embodied in his life on earth. And you see, these things transcended concerns about money and success and financial security. Because you see, truth has implications. Truth affects our choices. Bashar al-Assad in Syria, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, members of al-Qaeda are making choices right now based on their worldviews, just as Stalin, Mao, and Hitler did in the last century. But you see, Nelson Mandela made different choices. So did Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma. You see, in the kind of world we live in is the sum total of all of these choices that people make. So we go right back to the issue we began with. What is truth? What is right? What is wrong? What is unjust? You know, Jesus was once asked by an expert in the law, "What is the greatest commandment of all?" And he answered with this famous verse. Jesus said, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind." He said, "This is the first and the greatest commandment. And the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." He then proceeded to tell them the story of the Good Samaritan, which we know so well might be the greatest moral teaching in all of history. And if you unpack that short parable, there's a profound conclusion for Christians in the 21st century. And you remember the story of Jesus tells a man was on the Jericho Road, and he fell into the hands of robbers who beat and robbed him and left him for dead, bleeding and hurting on the side of the road. And along come three different characters. First, a priest, good Jew, you know, a priest from the priesthood of Aaron. But he passes by the man, looks at him and passes by. Then a Levite comes, another holy man from the Jewish religion. He sees the man at the side of the road and passes by. And the third man who comes is a Samaritan. And a Samaritan was kind of a half-breed theologically. They had split off from Judaism few centuries before. They were actually despised by the Jews. They were hated, despised individuals considered outside of the kingdom of God and cursed. So this cursed person is the one that stops. He binds up the wounds of the man. He treats the wounds with oil. He puts the man on his donkey. He takes the man to an inn down the road a few miles. He leaves money for the proprietor of the inn and says, "Please take care of the man and nurse him back to health. And if you need more money, I'll return to check on him, and I'll pay whatever it takes." Jesus then asks the expert in the law who asked the question, "Who is my neighbor?" And the man said, "The one who showed mercy on him is the best neighbor." The man could not even say the word Samaritan. He couldn't say the Samaritan was a good neighbor. He said the man who had mercy. And Jesus concludes with these, "Go and do likewise." Be like the Good Samaritan. Be a neighbor to the person that you encounter in need. Now, if you want to understand the moral dynamic of what was happening there, there were three conditions that made these religious leaders culpable and guilty of passing by. They were aware of the man's suffering. They saw him right there. But they couldn't say they didn't know. They had access to the man. He was right there, and all they had to do was cross the road, help the man, bring him assistance. And they had the ability to do something. Awareness, access, and ability. So the profound question this raises in the 21st century, we are certainly aware of the poverty and injustice in our world. We're aware that 2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. We're aware that 18,000 children under the age of 5 die every single day of preventable causes. We're aware of human trafficking. We're aware that 750 million people in the world don't have clean water. We are aware. We see it on the news. We read it on the internet. We have ready access to these people by air travel and by proxy through NGOs and nonprofit organizations. And we have the ability to make a difference that is unprecedented in the history of the human race with our advances in technology and economics and medicine and health and vaccination. We know how to work in poor communities to make a difference. So what's the conclusion? Like the priest and the Levite, we have the same responsibility to help the 18,000 children that will die today of preventable causes. They are all our neighbors. We have 7 billion neighbors. Love your neighbor as yourself. But you see, whether we respond depends on the worldview and the values that we've embraced. And our worldview and our values shape what we believe and shape what we do. Truth matters. Now, had I believed that personal success was a higher value, happiness was a higher value, I would have never left the corporate world to come to World Vision. And I'm no saint. I'm just a kind of an average Christian person trying to do what is right based on my understanding of truth. So now at the very end of this lecture, I finally have a few things to say about the end of poverty. I actually choose to be an optimist about what's happening in our world. It's pretty easy to be a pessimist. But I'm an optimist because I work with people every day who see that their purpose in life is to make the world a better place, to help those in need, to use their money for the needs of others rather than their own wants and desires. I've sat across from people and asked them for $25 million and gotten the answer of yes. $25 million could buy a lot of pleasure in this world. But some of our incredible World Vision donors, you know, have been very sacrificial. We have women on fixed income who are widows in their 80s that are skipping a meal every day so they can keep sponsoring their child. There are people making choices about their resources and their ability to help. Now, I could cite a lot of statistics I already have about poverty, and I won't do that tonight, but I believe that we could see the end of extreme poverty in our lifetimes, and maybe within as little as 20 years. I'm going to do some quick math for you. I want to ask the question, what would it take, what kind of force of will would it take in America to end poverty in our lifetimes? So the average per capita income in 2012 in America was $42,693, one of the wealthiest nations in the history of the world. If you multiply that times the population of 316 million people, you get a total annual income of Americans of $13.5 trillion. There's a lot of zeros on that. And I asked the question, what if we could get every American to give one-half of 1% of this income to make the world a better place? One-half of 1%, it would equal, on average, 58 cents per American per day. I think we could afford that if we chose to. That 58 cents a day would produce about $67 billion a year of available money. In over 20 years, that's about $1.3 trillion that we would have in our wallet. And then I like to say, let's go shopping. Let's take that $1.3 billion and go shopping. And these are numbers that we've derived from various research and academic reports. But we could bring universal access to clean water for $263 billion. That's about what it would take. We could eliminate hunger, essentially. Estimates are about $400 billion to eliminate hunger on the planet, have sustainable agriculture, enough food to feed everyone. Universal education is a bargain. It's only about $100 billion. That's about two supertankers or two aircraft carriers. Only about $100 billion. Eradicate malaria from the planet, about 50 $54 billion is one estimate. We believe we could create as many as a billion new jobs through microfinance and economic development for about $120 billion. So I want you to see now that we have eliminated hunger, thirst, malaria, illiteracy from the planet. We've created a billion new jobs. We've got $360 billion left to spend. What could we do with that? Maybe tackle homelessness and gang violence in the United States, maybe build 10,000 clinics and hospitals around the world. I mean, you name it. But it would cost us the staggering sum of 58 cents per American per day to do this. I think you get the point. We have the resources. We lack the will. Now, I realize also in an audience of academics that money doesn't solve the world's problems. People do. It takes institutions, it takes strategy, it takes deep expertise and sacrificial hard work. And where do these things come from? They come from people who choose to invest their lives in doing this kind of work, even though they could invest their lives doing something else and make a lot more money for themselves. And those choices are made based on the worldviews that people have, which are based on their understanding of truth and meaning, and that takes us back to the beginning and to the end. Truth really does matter. And the end of poverty begins with the question of the meaning of life. And the fate of the human race hangs on the choices that millions of people will make about what is true, and what is right, and what is good. Finally, I'm done, Chris. Thank you for being so attentive.